Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. We continue to celebrate Jazz Appreciation Month. First, we go to the WBGO archives for a 2014 conversation between the late WBGO host Michael Bourne and superstar performer Lady Gaga.
Now, returning to jazz, it's like returning to my true nature, and I'm able to truly look at my life and myself and how I've changed.
WBGO's Daybreak host Gary Walker interviewed his longtime friend and Grammy Award-winning pianist, composer, and band leader, Maria Schneider, last year.
With pen and ink, that's how I made my living. For years, that's how I made my living in New York.
I'll chat with dancer and producer Mercedes Ellington about the legacy of her grandfather, Duke.
First of all, his motto was beyond category.
And we'll hear about some violinists who met in Brooklyn's flourishing music scene. All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. It was back in 2014 that WBGO's legendary announcer Michael Bourne spoke with eventual 16-time Grammy Award-winning singer Lady Gaga about her duet album of jazz standards with Tony Bennett, Cheek to Cheek.
Heaven, I'm in heaven, and my heart beats so that I can hardly speak, and I seem to find the happiness I seek. When we're together dancing cheek to cheek.
What is the story of this music that you're singing now with Tony Bennett?
Well, you know, I started singing jazz when I was really very young. I was maybe 13 years old. And I had been listening to it with my mom on Sundays. She would always play Billie Holiday on Sunday. So then around 13, you know, that's when I discovered Ella Fitzgerald. And I started to go out down the street. There was a boys' school where they had a jazz band, and I would audition to sing in it, and they loved my jazz voice, so they would have me sing a lot of songs. So then I learned a lot more about the Great American Songbook. But I had a wonderful teacher, Mr. Phillips. He came to me one day, and he said, you know, you really got to sing this song. He said, I just think you could really sing the hell out of this song. And he played it for me, and he sort of sang it to me on the piano, and it was Billy Strayhorn, Lush Life. And I was just a kid. So, you know, I didn't really understand what the song was about, and I didn't, I'd never really heard such an intricate, complex melodic line like that before. But I started to cry. And I got very emotional when he played it for me, and I loved it. And I then listened to all the different versions of it and tried to, you know, create my own and just improvise with the song as much as I could. But it wasn't until 15 years later, now in this moment with Mr. Tony Bennett, that I started to sing the song in the studio, and I cried again. And it was the same tears, except for this time I knew exactly what the song was about.
I used to visit all the very gay places, those come-what-may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life to get the feel of life. From jazz and cocktails.
Now, returning to jazz, it's like returning to my true nature, and I'm able to truly look at my life and myself and how I've changed.
Michael Bourne's interview with Lady Gaga and Tony Bennett was also the cover story of the November issue of Downbeat magazine back on October 21st of 2014. You can hear the entire interview at WBGO.org.
Hi, I'm Gary Walker, and welcome to WBGO Studios. We have quite a special guest with us here today. Think about this. What is it that revolves around music, that makes the music happen and brings people to it? It's one word. It's called community. And for Maria Schneider, that community was made up of great musicians who would get together every Monday night at Visioni's down in the village, and they would walk in the door with then a very limited playbook. But what made that playbook different every week? It was the community of musicians and their ability to solo differently each and every time. Time, 30 years later, we're talking with Maria Schneider. 7 Grammy Awards, an NEA Jazz Master, also nominated for a Pulitzer Prize for her recording Data Lords. And it's always a pleasure to speak with Maria Schneider. Hello, Maria.
Hi, what an introduction. Thank you.
We go all the way back to your very first recording. It was 1994, and it was called Evanescence. And part of that release will be featured in your upcoming performance celebrating 3 decades at Town Hall this Saturday night at 8 o'clock in New York City. Evanescence, dedicated to the legendary Gil Evans, who you had a chance to work with. How did that come about, you and Gil Evans together?
Well, first of all, it was a dream for me, you know, like a fantasy, a wild fantasy to get to work with Gil. And actually, when I was back at the University of Minnesota one night listening to his music, I actually had a vision of it, like being kind of an apprentice to him. It's bizarre, but it's true. And so I moved to New York and I was working as a music copyist in an office. And one day I was working at the Xerox machine and this composer, Tom Pearson, some might remember that name, came in and I was Xeroxing his score and we were talking and we ended up going to lunch because I was on my way to lunch and he was going out too. And he asked me who my favorite writers were. And I went on and on about Gil. And he called me that night and he said, I didn't tell you today, but Gil is my best friend. And he needs somebody to work with him and he wants to meet you.
Wow.
That's such a New York story, right? And I remember when it happened, I just couldn't even believe it. I jumped up and down, literally spinning in circles, just screaming. And then I was so nervous when I first met him. He had me come to a rehearsal where his band was rehearsing and he wanted me to copy things. And then I learned about how Gil wrote scores. It would all be on one line, like a tiny and a miniature paper he got from King Brand Music. It was like tiny paper, like maybe 6 inches by 3 inches with little staves and little pinpricks of notes saying, show it with a little arrow that said, this is an alto and that's a berry. And I was like, thank God I had good eyes back then, you know? And so I copied it out quick and then got it to him right at the rehearsal. And it was amazing.
And in those days, the copying part was calligraphy pens. I mean, you actually had to copy all that stuff.
Yeah, with pen and ink. That's how I made my living for 8 years. That's how I made my living in New York, doing that for Gil, for Bob, for other people. Then Gil started having me do like some reorchestrations for him, which was like, you know, that's like, I don't know, I didn't deserve to do that. And I'm sure I did a terrible job. But anyway, it was an amazing thing to be around these legends, you know.
So, you know, you mentioned a word that to me is very important in your career. And that word is vision, because I looked to that very first recording when you came by WBGO, when that record came out and we chatted about it. But tunes, in addition to Evanescence, that pays tribute to Gil Evans, but I'm thinking of other tunes like Wordly, which were the little monsters that would come out at night.
Yeah, there were a lot of that music too. It's amazing. I look back at it, and I think that album, for some people, that's their favorite album we made. We caught a magic, but a lot of the music is very earnest and kind of dark. You know, and my later music got brighter and more unabashedly beautiful. You know, I started to realize, actually, when I went to Brazil, that music could be deep and beautiful and joyful. It doesn't have to be dark and brooding. So my first album's a little more brooding, but I still love it.
Yeah. I think it was Egberto Gismonte who said to you, you know what I hear in your music? I hear joy.
Yeah. Wow. You're so, I don't know, you studied or you have a great memory or something. You're right. That happened. Yeah.
I've been following along Talk about Allegress. Talk about that recording. That was your third recording, and it's also part of the box set that is coming out that will accompany this performance on Saturday night, and that is called Decades. Does it seem like three decades to you?
Maybe five. No, it kind of does. It kind of does, because if I look back at the pictures and I see how young we are, so one time when I was working with Gil Evans, he had an apartment just north of me here in the 70s on the west side. And one time I was organizing stuff and he just lived in a studio there. And he was in the bathroom, and all of a sudden I heard him screaming from the bathroom, and I went running towards the bathroom. I said, "What, Gil, are you okay?" And he said, "I'm an old man. Oh my God, I just looked in the mirror and I'm an old man." And then he explained how when we're working together, he doesn't feel different than I am in age so much. And then he went in the bathroom and he sincerely was shocked. And you know, that's the way I kind of feel, because you were talking about Visionis. I still feel like that young band, Greg Gisbert, Tony Cadillac, you know, Frank Kimbrough, who's not even around anymore. Lori Frink, who's not even around anymore. So, you know, Scott Robinson, Keith O'Quinn. But, you know, we were the young ones, and I still feel like we're the young ones. And then I look at us and I go, we definitely are not the young ones anymore. And I just don't know how that happened. It's like, I don't know, somehow I thought we would all defy time.
You can hear Gary Walker's entire interview with Maria Schneider at WBGO.org. Dancer, choreographer, and producer Mercedes Ellington joined me on WBGO late last year to talk about Such Sweet Thunder, a special concert honoring the life and music of her late grandfather, Duke Ellington. Here's a portion of that chat. Why at this point did you want to have this special celebration for your grandfather?
Well, first of all, he liked celebrations. Any excuse, any reason to do an album, which is what he did, because anytime any country had asked him to appear, he would then thank them by writing an album. But we chose to do an album from his visit to England. And that is when people think of England and literature, Shakespeare comes to mind. Now, I think that my grandfather had a lot in common with Shakespeare, and they liked to cover the same things, the same subject matter, history, the comedy and tragedy. And of course, Shakespeare also did the sonnets and I think that my grandfather, well, first of all, he was his motto was beyond category. So he didn't like to be hemmed down by any situations or any rules and regulations as far as music is concerned, because he liked to, you know, fool around with different types of structures of music and subject matter of music. And so then here we have the Shakespearean suite, which he's dealing now with these characters that Shakespeare wrote about, and he's putting them into a jazz music background.
Such Sweet Thunder is rarely her complete performance, so this is really a special night.
Yeah, and for some reason, there's a lot of Shakespeare going around at this time, you know? In Broadway musicals and in recordings and concerts and things. And so, I mean, I don't think we were actually affected by that, but it happened that we were planning on doing some concerts that reflected the Ellington catalog. So we had done the Ellington Strayhorn Nutcracker. When we went to Russia, I went with him. I was doing No, No, Nanette on Broadway, and I managed to wrangle 2 weeks worth of a vacation to go with them on their 5-week tour. And they were invited a State Department tour, and we were following Alvin Ailey. he had been invited. So then we were the next Americans to come to Russia. And in his plans, which were completely ignored, he wanted to try to find the original score of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker so that he could complete the first act, because he and Billy only did the second act. So he wanted to, that he never did, because they kept us so busy, but traveling and all of the activities that we were doing. And the Russian people were so giving and so knowledgeable of the catalog. We said, okay, this is a remote country that had never really been that tied to Americana, but they were in the music. So it proves that, to me, that music can conquer anything, everything.
Absolutely. The legacy of the Ellington family continues on. I'm curious and would love to know, your father, Mercer, of course, took over the band. And yes. Can you take us into a conversation that you had with your dad and your grandfather that maybe we could learn something from?
Well, both of them were my grandfather and my father were sometimes at odds with each other. My father, when he was playing with the Duke Ellington Orchestra, was fourth trumpet, flugelhorn, and he was in charge of keeping the guys in the band together. That was a terrible job, because there were some guys who, Cat Anderson, and I could name a couple of other people, his nickname was the Rabbit. Hodges wasn't that bad, but we had, the trumpet section was a great deal, because my father told me that there was a consistent description of the feelings of and the output of the musicians because of the instruments that they chose to play. The saxophones, he started with the saxophones, and he told me that the saxophones are usually not very bright, because that is the easiest instrument to play, unless they play another or other reed instruments. Then that meant that they were, you know, a little bit more able to do lots of things. The trombones were usually very slippery, so you had to watch out what you did, what you said to them, and watch out what they said to you. And the trumpet players at the top of the tier, if they're displayed that way, are usually like opera divas, because they are at the top of the tier and because of the sound that they produce and the way they have to stand when they produce that sound. And he shifted over to the percussionists, the drummers. They're usually fine after their first nervous breakdown. He shifted to the bass players, and he described them as being the salt of the earth. He never did say anything about the piano. So I'm assuming that he just wanted to lay off, you know.
Mm. So as this performance is going on, what will you be thinking about?
I'll be thinking about what they would think of this performance, and that I would be fulfilling their, their hopes, because as I said, my grandmother, my mother's mother, raised me. So I really had little times with my father and my father's side of the family. I would go to see them at the Apollo. My grandmother would take me there, and the orchestra members' wives would sit with me. And at that time, we would see, it would be a movie and a show and a movie and a show, and I was in heaven. And then we'd go backstage, and the orchestra members' wives, they would bring fried chicken, and I was in heaven. And then after the show, the last show, we'd go down to this wonderful restaurant that had tablecloths on 125th Street, and we'd have more fried chicken and food, and I was in heaven. And so I just associated good times and meetings with all of these guys. And the when they heard that I was dancing, they used to call me the dancer. And I remember being with Billy Strayhorn, when I was really, really little. I thought he was another child. So I used to hang out with him because he was my height, you know. And I would like to sit with him whenever we were sitting together. Well, he was great. You know, he was unbelievable. And he was very courteous to me. And he was, because at that time it was, you know, there were no other children around, but I was also very quiet, and I wasn't a problem for them to drag me around. But when we went to Russia, that was really the most incredible situation. Nobody knows about this exchange, but my grandfather used to have a glass of Coca-Cola on the piano during the set, and he'd take sips of from it, and he'd put sugar in it. And so one of the promoters here in New York, Phoebe Jacobs, she wanted to make sure that he had enough Coca-Cola for Russia. So she calls up Coca-Cola, and they never answered her. So she then thought about Joan Crawford, who was married to Pepsi-Cola. So she called up Joan Crawford, who was a big fan of Duke Ellington's. And Joan Crawford sent over Pepsi-Cola with the instructions, just don't let him see the can. So he had all of this. And in turn, Pepsi-Cola caught the contract for Stolichnaya. So they brought Stolichnaya back to America. So Stolichnaya became the first Russian vodka in America, and Pepsi-Cola became the first American soft drink in Russia of that trip.
That's a great story.
It's ridiculous, you know.
It's a great one.
You can see my entire interview with Mercedes Ellington on the WBGO YouTube channel. On Sunday, April 19th, an electric performance will take place at a synagogue on Manhattan's Lower East Side. Two violinists steeped in the traditional music of southern India will join a Yiddish folk band that includes a klezmer fiddler. As WBGO's John Kalish reports, the violinists met in Brooklyn's flourishing improvised music scene.
Jake Shulman-Ment performs in a number of klezmer bands and duos.
There are so many different violinists doing different kinds of improvised music in Brooklyn. That's an amazing thing about New York, is that there are all these different kinds of music scenes that really do have opportunities to overlap and cross-germinate. When I travel, I realize that is really not true in most places.
20 years ago, Shulman-Ment ran into Trina Basu in Brooklyn. Basu performs with her husband Arun Ramamurthy as a duo. The two violinists are classically trained, but also practitioners of Carnatic music, the traditional classical music of southern India, which they improvise. Arun Ramamurthy also performs in a trio that includes bass and drums. It blends Carnatic music with jazz. Last year, the two Indian violinists performed with Jake Shulman-Ment's band Midwood, which has been described as psychedelic klezmer, at the Museum of Jewish Heritage in Lower Manhattan. They played a mix of klezmer and Carnatic tunes.
Mm-hmm.
It just felt very clear to me that we were sort of on a similar page there with the music we were doing.
Again, Jake Shulman-Ment.
When we get together, we all just feel like it's so easy to make music together, and it just really flows.
I think we all have this deep reverence and respect and love for the traditional music.
Trina Basu.
We've all spent years getting deep within that tradition. But then I think we're all itching to create something very authentic to who we are, growing up in a very multicultural country and world, and then connecting with those different sides of ourselves through our art form.
All three of these violinists agree that klezmer and Carnatic music share a spiritual foundation. Arun Ramamurthy says the two styles also have a close connection to vocal music.
In klezmer music and in raga music, the way of approaching playing the instrument is very connected to vocalization. When I hear Jake play, he might sing something and then play it. They sing the melodies, they play the melodies. It's very, very, very similar in raga music. You know, everything that I can play, I can sing. And I may have learned to sing it before I ever learned to play it. And then I put it on my instrument. And that's the space where we can really communicate with each other. And I feel like that communication is sometimes easy for us.
The Carnatic performances often include the drone of a traditional instrument called the tanpura, but sometimes an electronic device attached to a Bluetooth speaker is used. In this klezmer Carnatic mashup, the drone is provided by either Midwood's electric guitar player or accordionist. When the Indian musicians join their Yiddish brethren, the combined ensemble will perform a medley that melds Carnatic music with klezmer music. Once again, Jake Shulman-Ment.
I think I have been making an effort to do these kinds of collaborations with people coming from really disparate music worlds. It's something that I really am aspiring to do more and more. In the political moment that we're in, I'm finding it more complicated to do that and also more necessary, if that makes sense.
The psychedelic klezmer ensemble Midwood will be joined by the Carnatic violin duo of Trina Basu and Arun Ramamurthy at the Eldred Street Synagogue on Sunday, April 19th at 3 p.m. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. If you enjoy the news programming you hear on your public radio station, WBGO, please support it now during Jazz Appreciation Month at 800-499-9246 or make a financial contribution from anywhere in the world at wbgo.org/support. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.